Again, please be seated. We're back in session on our second case this morning. It's case number 56146, Monty Bass versus State. Janelle Thomas as counsel for the appellant. Mr. Dave Stanton as counsel for the respondent. Ms. Thomas.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Janelle Thomas, representing Monty Bass. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. On March 22, 2012, after the briefing in this case was completed, Mr. Brass was killed in the Ely State Prison. In what appears to be an issue of first impression before this court, I'm asking this court to apply the abatement doctrine by vacating Mr. Brass's conviction and directing the district court to dismiss the charges against him. This issue has been addressed by numerous courts, and a variety of approaches have been taken. The majority rule, and the rule adopted by the federal courts, is that the proceedings are abated ab initio, the judgment vacated, and the charges are dismissed. There are several jurisdictions, including a couple of federal courts, that abate the judgment but leave the restitution order. In this case, with Mr. Brass, who was indigent, who was living on Social Security disability based upon his extremely low IQ, restitution is not a legitimate issue. I recognize that a few states have rejected the abatement doctrine, and still other courts have came up with different solutions. There's really quite a variety. As interesting as the debate is as to the policy reasons for which approach to take, I submit that this issue is most easily resolved by looking at NRS 1.030, which provides that when there is no statutory law in the state, that we apply the common law. As I set forth in the motion, the early cases in this country appear uniform in their adoption of the abatement doctrine. I would note United States versus Dunn from 1909 in the Ninth Circuit, which quoted United States versus Daniel out of the U.S. Supreme Court, an 1848 case, and List versus Pennsylvania, an 1888 case out of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Isn't it the modern trend, though, to reject the abatement doctrine?
Some courts recently have rejected the abatement doctrine.
Is that primarily on policy reasons or mootness?
Primarily on policy reasons that are tied to mootness. Much of the debate has concerned victim rights, amendments to state constitutions. I note that in our state constitution concerning victims' rights, there is no provision for restitution, which would distinguish us from several of those states.
Pending civil proceedings as a result of criminal acts?
We don't have that as an issue in this case.
No, but generally, if we're being asked to adopt the abatement policy, then something we have to consider.
Certainly, and those proceedings, as they do in the federal system, as they do in the majority of other states, would be able to go forward in the civil case depending on the cause of action and the nature of the remedy that is being sought. But whereas here, a defendant has not yet had his one entitlement as of right to direct review from this court of his judgment and conviction in accord with the common law and in NRS 1.030, as well as the well-thought-out decisions of the federal courts and the majority of state courts, I submit that the abatement doctrine should be applied. There are a number of policy reasons in support of that position. The appellate review by this court is a critical function in the criminal justice system. When a defendant goes to trial and enters a plea of not guilty, he's entitled to a judgment by a jury, but he's also entitled by statute, and I would submit due process as well, to review by this court to review those errors. It's also, if there's merit to having an administrative rule that is consistent with the federal courts, that has been applied for a long time by other courts, that's easily applied without a lot of variation, and certainly with this court's docket, having a straightforward rule of abatement, unlike some of those other courts that have adopted more intermediate approaches, would certainly be very simple to apply. Some courts adopt the abatement doctrine on a simple rationale, But without the body of the defendant, there is no way to punish the defendant. And still others look to the memory of the surviving family members, friends, community, and the recognition that the defendant should be able to die in peace at this stage of proceedings without having his name and reputation tarnished by a conviction that is not capable of being reviewed. Unless the court has questions, I would like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal. We ask you to vacate Mr. Brass's conviction and ask the district court to dismiss the charges against him.
Mr. Stanton, on behalf of the district attorney, may I ask for any questions? Mr. Stanton, on behalf of the district attorney.
Thank you, Evers. As far as your question about the background, I think it's policy and the policies of, as I review the case law, indicates that if there's issues of note or actual claims of innocence, those are the policy considerations where the doctrine, if it has any usefulness anymore, would come into play. I think under the facts of this case, as argued in the appellate briefs, none of the issues apply in this case that would require or suggest that the abatement doctrine is an appropriate revenue in this particular case. I think it's relatively straightforward and historically expressed numerous times about the condition of the appellate system in this state, the docket that this court is under, and that if there are compelling reasons that would necessitate hearing the issues in a particular case and the unique facts that you have before you, and I would suggest that it is an inappropriate use of the appellate court time here under these facts and under these issues. And unless the court had any specific questions of the state, that's the position of the state as it relates to the abatement doctrine.
How could you comment on how you believe personhood applies to this case, our decision in the personhood case?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I can shed any additional light on that. I mean, I know that there is an appropriate claim that there is a right to an individual having their record be reviewed, especially in the light, as counsel stated, the only process of direct review in this case to determine whether or not sufficient evidence existed or there was a basis for reversing the case. As it's outlined in this case, I don't know if any of those facts ring that bell, if you will, in this particular case. I could imagine that there would be limited cases, very limited cases, frankly, reviewing the criminal docket before this court that would ring that bell. But other than those issues as I've outlined them, that would make it a compelling interest to do that. Nothing in this case, nor what has been argued, I think raises to that level.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Stanton?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Stanton, what in your view is the common law rule, and what is the source of the common law rule for abatement, the abatement doctrine?
Well, without going, I guess, into the history of the common law rule, if that's what Justice Hardesty, you're inquiring, the source of it, I believe, has to do with the right of an individual to be, their character not be smirched by a conviction. My reading of that, or in the context of the abatement doctrine, is more in the lines of the civil context as the source of where the rule was generated under the common law doctrine, not so much in the criminal context. The actual source, Your Honor, I would tell you that I don't know historically where from common law it generated. I don't know that it's as clear-cut as counsel suggests that common law embraces the abatement doctrine in whole, in toto. That indeed, there, in my reading of the courts that have addressed the issue, embraced it and rejected it, that it is a factors that court have set forth that are important to them that I think has developed over time since the indoctrination of the common law principles. So I would think that the, at least as I read the modern trend of it, is that the courts look to what is important at that time to embrace or to reject in part or in whole the doctrine.
I appreciated your comments about the importance or lack of importance in addressing a case factually like this, but there is a significant legal question in my mind under 1.030 where the court is directed to look at common law. The source of the common law on this subject becomes enormously important.
I would agree. And, you know, to be honest with you, as far as the source of it and the history and the integrity of it as it's worked through the criminal justice system for 200 years, I don't know if I can accurately place a historical perspective on that.
I guess the thing that troubles me is that when we talk about modern trends or when we talk about differences of approach in various cases, we need those to track us back to good old, merry old England or wherever our common law comes from.
Yeah, I agree, because often it's stated the trend, but then it loses sight as to whether or not there's the proper foundation to even embrace that doctrine to begin with. And I think it's certainly my review of this tended to be towards the former as to the latter, but I agree with you as an intellectual foundation, it's absolutely critical to do that.
Thank you.
Defense has argued in terms of the federal approach, looking at the state approach, the states more specifically, they seem to be moving away from that absolute federal approach. Should we look at that? Should we look at a case-by-case scenario? Or, I mean, excluding the fact that, yes, we have a big docket, but that should not come into play to make this decision as to what we should do.
I agree, Your Honor. I think as a matter of principle in criminal cases, that's absolutely critical in that the docket, while a factor, should not be the overriding one. To answer your question directly, I believe it is a distinction between this federal and the state system as those entities are derived in the criminal justice systems that are bifurcated both as you evaluate the federal system and as you evaluate the state system. Because as I'm sure you're more than well aware, the differences between the two. And those differences, I think, are significant, qualitative, and do make a difference. And I think that it shouldn't per se be a case-by-case basis, but I agree with you that there should be an adoption of a procedure and assessment of this situation, and then whether or not those particular facts of each case fall within those parameters. So I think absolutely that it should be a rule derived by this court that embraces all, but that the particular facts of each case be considered and be an integral part of your assessment.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you.
Ms. Thomas?
As an initial matter, I would like to say this is not a case where I'm running away from the merits of the decision at all. I would happily argue the merits of this case in a heartbeat. This trial had a lot of problems, and it's spelled out in the brief. And if it's the court's decision to address the merits of this case, I'm ready tomorrow. But as a general rule, most courts are not taking that approach. And I would note that twice as many state courts follow the abatement ab initio rule as those that have rejected it. So it is not just the federal system following that rule. Many, many state courts are also following that rule. As to the origin of the common law, I referred the court to the Daniels case from the U.S. Supreme Court. It relies upon Conlon's Digest and the Bacon's Abridgment. I'm not going to hold myself out as an expert on the common law. I looked at those sources. I thought about bringing them in to talk about them. it's a subject that you could spend weeks and weeks upon trying to figure out old common law terms and what they mean. But what we do have is the Ninth Circuit saying that that was the common law. We have the U.S. Supreme Court saying that that was the common law. Certainly the state has provided no authority saying that that is not the common law history of the rule. And we have a statute that says we should apply the common law. Certainly the state has the ability, if they think that's wrong, to go to the legislature, ask for a statute, and have some guidance on the issue. But for this case, for Mr. Brass, we have a statute that says follow the common law. We have a lot of cases saying that is the historical rule of this rule. We have the cases rejecting the rule have, to my knowledge, not rejected that as the common law history. And in these circumstances, I think that the proper course here is to vacate the judgment of conviction and order the charges dismissed and be done with the case.
If I follow part of your logic as you went through that, though, is if there's no specific statute, then shouldn't we just be governed by the fact that Newton should be applied at this time?
I submit that the common law rule, as provided for in NRS 1.030,
I understand, but just I'm saying, since you're saying that there's not a rule in place, you want us to harken back to common law, but since we're not totally clear in Nevada, without transgressing back to Utah and California and trying to make sense of what they did or didn't do, and looking and saying it's a legislative call, we've had a trial on the merits and good, bad, or indifferent, the party is deceased. The cloak of innocence has now been partially stripped away. It's not absolute, because as you say, the appeal is pending. Should we now just say, since we have a party who's deceased, it is moot? Or should we refine that a little bit and say, we should look at it case by case to see if important legal issues are presented as to the viability of that conviction?
I think there's the third approach, which is the approach taken by the federal courts and the majority of states.
It's an interesting position in light of the modern law, where civil and criminal law intertwine into each other. And it's not just the, as you began, the innocence of the alleged perpetrator, but also the family sometimes of the victim, because of insurance policies and all kinds of other things that now intertwine into what we're doing. So it is just not a simple stage we're stuck with.
And I agree there are absolutely other cases. The Kinley case out of Texas, which had a huge restitution judgment to the Enron victims, that presents a different case. And that hasn't been my interest, and that has not been the issue that I have been researching and briefing. And there may be others who are better equipped to talk about the restitution issue. But in the absence of that type of restitution and a defendant who has an estate that's capable of paying any restitution, I think looking in this case that the proper role is to, yes, recognize that addressing the appellate issues, while there are some very interesting issues in this case and I believe very meritorious issues, is perhaps not the best use of judicial resources, and there can be no real remedy for Mr. Brass as to the merits of the case. There is, however, the ability to recognize that the case is not just at the Nevada court level, but also at the judicial district court level by vacating the judgment and also ordering dismissal of the charges.
Ms. Thomas, I didn't get a chance to look at the judgment of conviction. Was there even restitution ordered in this case?
I believe there was. I apologize for not having it with me. I believe there were for funeral expenses.
I didn't get a chance to look at it.
Nothing beyond that. And certainly there's still the co-defendant in place. But the fact is, this is a case where restitution was not going to be paid. but Mr. Brass, having now lost his life, I submit is at least entitled to have his name back. And I would ask this court to do that.
Further questions to Ms. Thomas? Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Staten, for presenting this interesting argument to this court. This court will stand in recess until 2 o'clock for further arguments, but at 12, we're going to be presenting Chief Justice Awards to Senior Judge McGrody and Senior Justice of the Peace Osterley. This matter stands submitted.